Can you hear me? Okay, better. I need to be closer. So just linking with the great presentation that Sarah just gave us, as we cannot treat heat access separately, when you have a hypothyroidism in an emergency unit, if you give the thyroid without checking cortisol, you may induce an adrenal crisis. Likewise, you formally use corticoids to reduce the conversion T4 to T3. So it's not that we need to go further to understand that axes are intercorrelated. So myself, I'm going to talk about adrenal fatigue. First of all, I do not blame those who use to practice for adrenal fatigue because low energy is a major complaint, the most common complaint we have. And doctors, in an attempt to try to help their patients, they assume that low cortisol levels, which is the opposite of what Sarah just told us. The problem is most hypercortisolism instead. But that's what we're going to talk about, as well as the CBG, cortisol binding globulin levels, which has an important role in the cortisol homeostasis. So our agenda here, we're basically going to talk about the history of adrenal fatigue, how it has become so spread, how it has been practiced, and how we have research that showed that it does not exist in the way we think. But at the same time, I think it's a moral obligation for me to teach everyone how to assess and to address fatigue in patients. So if these patients are not treated for fatigue, what can we do for these patients? So a walk through adrenal fatigue. We have, first of all, this book here. Well, before anything, in 1969, a Dr. John Tinterba was a leaked hypocortisolism specialist, said that 2/3 of the population had a low cortisol production. So then in 1998, Dr. William Wilson here, he published a book. This is a book, not a study. It's important to say there's a huge difference. Claiming that adrenal fatigue would be the 21st century syndrome. And he had some leaked pathophysiology for this supposed disease, and that's what we're gonna debunk step by step further in this presentation. So what we observed here is that this book was further confirmed by some clinicians by therapeutical tests, by providing glucocorticoid, which indeed improved the well-being state from these patients. But why did they get better? That's what we're going to understand here. So there are those claimers of adrenal fatigue. There are reasons for that. So these patients are really fatigued. They do not find in traditional medicine the reason for their fatigue. So they are totally unaddressed. So they look for other doctors who are unsatisfied with the lack of response. So what can I do for these patients? Sometimes these patients are confounded and they are referred to psychiatrists. So what do we do with a patient that has a complaint of fatigue, no apparent reason for the fatigue, and there's nothing much to do, apparently, as you're going to see here. So with this, there was an increasing movement forward the low cortisol hypothesis, which was reinforced by the therapeutical response. So these patients were theoretically with low cortisol levels. When you gave them replacement with glucocorticoid, they improved. So this would be, look, this is the cure. That was the reason. So let's understand why that was not really the reason. So it's easy for you to get people that are fatigued, complaining, unsatisfied. They're quite suggestionable. So you just say, look, do you have fatigue? Do you wake up really? Do you have a refreshing sleep? You just have adrenal fatigue. So, but we forget there's more, a very important thing in medicine, which is differential diagnosis. For example, if you have one symptom that leads to a diagnosis, we call this pathognomon. It's rare and it's quite valuable because you don't need any further exams to perform the diagnosis of this certain condition. So when you have fatigue, you have literally hundreds of causes. At the same time, it's a great marketing tool because it's really easy to convince your unsatisfied patient to bring to your practice. And in the short term, as they improve with glucocorticoid replacement, they get really satisfied. So it's a marketing tool that you have to get a short-term satisfaction from your patients. So I make a direct head-to-head comparison here between traditional medicine associations and the new medicine associations. So while traditional medicine thinks that any of these kind of practices are a synonym of malpractice or a way to get patients willing to pay, or one more of the inventions from the unrecognized medical associations, the new medical associations think that this is one of many underdiagnosed hormonal dysfunctions, or a marker of poor health status, or a sign of the failure of the traditional medicine. I think our role here is to make a real bridge. I'm trained through endocrinology, a very conservative association. I've never really criticized, but I always question what I've been given in terms of subject. So I've perhaps making a bridge because I get a little bit, I have a mixed feeling about patients having to choose which type of medicine they have to go through. So why don't they be given someone that provides both types and giving them real and impartial view over each type, each approach, or each treatment path? That's the reason why I think that we should all learn about all types of medicine here. So findings from our systematic review on adrenal fatigue. This idea of performing a systematic review is the huge spread of the use of glucocorticoid, at least in Brazil. So medical doctors were starting to prescribe hydrocortisone or cortisol bioidentical to every patient who complained about fatigue, regardless of any other state, regardless of the associated symptoms. So we decided to look up for some articles. So just to show here, I'll be back. So this is where we published at BMC Endocrine Disorders. And we were at Washington Post, Wikipedia, Endocrine News. And we had a very high altimetric tension score saying that it has become spread. Thankfully and fortunately, it has become spread. So even these associations who claimed for the existence of adrenal fatigue, they are reevaluating this existence. Thankfully, they opened their eyes, which is great. I think that I kind of don't have the capacity to judge others. I'd rather just to see through the others' perspective and try to help others' doctors to improve their practice instead of keep blaming them of things. So I think we are all in the same planet to grow together. So instead of blaming those who used to practice as an adrenal fatigue doctors, I prefer to help them improve their practice. So what we observed here, and I'm sorry for my English, it's my first presentation, not my first presentation outside Brazil. I think I'm the only non-native speaker, but I hope that you guys, I make myself understood here and what I'm bringing here as the content. So we perform a real independent and impartial systematic review. We were not only stuck on standardized endocrine criteria for diagnosis of adrenal insufficiency. So we really looked for different articles. There were 3,470 articles that we read. It took like 3 years. We selected in the end, ultimately 58. So because we really believe that fatigue is an unaddressed symptom that needs to be evaluated, investigated, and there are a lot to be investigated in terms of pathophysiology of fatigue. So we try to understand the cortisol role here behind it. So we found some useful hormonal markers of fatigue, but no triggers. There's a huge difference between association and causality. This is something we need to be very aware that it's not that you have a lower cortisol level, that it means that lower cortisol is the cause of the symptom that you're observing. And we cannot base our therapies on markers, but you need to base our therapies on the root cause instead. So the most used one was the cortisol awakening response. For you guys to know, it's interesting that it's a quite validated marker. It's a cortisol. It's based on the assumption that when you wake up to 30 minutes after, your salivary cortisol increased on average 50%, but it could be between something between 30 and 70%. If you ask an endocrinologist, they don't know this marker, and it's quite validated. Well, most of them, the majority showed no differences between fatigued and non-fatigued subjects, whereas the others showed contradictory results. Similarly, there was another change here, sorry. So it could be used as a marker of improvement of burnout syndrome. So I'm not telling you not to use this as a marker, but again, as a marker. So you do the other things you have to do for your patient, as you're gonna see further in this presentation, and then we reevaluate this cortisol awakening response. Salivary cortisol rhythm, we base our multiple dosages of cortisol along the day when you wake up, after 30 minutes or 8 o'clock, 4 p.m., 11 p.m., there are some variations regarding how you test them. The majority also showed no differences, whereas the other ones showed some conflicting results. It's important to say here that when you have a blunted salivary loop here, it could be either to a blunted morning cortisol or a higher afternoon or evening cortisol level. So when you have the delta, you should understand it better always do together with an under the area curve calculation to try to understand the whole cortisol release during the day. So this is kind of, this is not as validated as a cortisol awakening response. So the direct awakening cortisol is the cortisol when you wake up, and it's more used for sleep quality assessments than the evaluation of the cortisol status. Most of them showed also normal levels. This is interesting, the dexamethasone suppression test, the DST, we usually use endocrinology for investigation of a hypercortisolism. Usually in depression, we have pseudocochine states that you don't have, you do not suppress cortisol levels with the use of dexamethasone. But here, they claim that for the other hand, to the other side, when you have a hypocortisolism, you have an over-suppression, an over and prolonged suppression of cortisol levels. The thing is, they use a lower dose because we usually have, we use 0.5, we use 1 milligram overnight, dexamethasone suppression test, they use 0.5. But indeed, we use now 0.25 milligrams, this is interesting, suppression test, a lack of suppression, the opposite from this, shows an impaired sleeping quality, so an unrefreshing sleep. So if you use 0.25 milligrams of dexamethasone and you do not suppress your cortisol levels after a night, it shows that your sleep quality is impaired. And it may be substituted to the polysomnography, which is, to me, it's a very uncomfortable test to be performed. There are several limitations regarding these studies in terms of their methodology, the assessments. They use false premises, so all the rationale is fine, but if the premises is not true, you're going to lead to wrong conclusions. Inadequate assessment of fatigue, of cortisol, non-validated tests. So, and most of them were descriptive. So if you look up the adrenal fatigue as an exact expression, you're going to find only 10 or 11 results in PubMed. Whereas if you look up for the Dr. Williams questionnaire, you will not find any article validating his questionnaire. So I'm not saying that you need to have a one-way level of evidence. We know that for natural medicine, for example, it's pretty hard for you to have one-way level of evidence, as it requires a lot of money for you to have many subjects and study a long-term study. And so we know that we do not have to have evidence for everything. And even the conservative medicine is learning the same thing now, but we can talk about this later on. Here we have a lot of limitations. So maybe we have some issues regarding the cortisol assessments, and maybe the answer is not exactly where we thought it was. So there's no substantiation for the use of glucocorticoid in case of any adrenal leaked impairment through this perspective. If you have a real adrenal impairment, you do have substantiation for the use of glucocorticoid. But one important thing here, despite the existence of adrenal fatigue, I do not blame doctors who used to practice, as I told you, except unless they were practicing because they found a way to make money. So if their intention was bad, yes, I could blame them. But otherwise, I think that these doctors were just trying to help their patients. So I'm helping these doctors to help their patients. And in the end, all we want is a better healthcare for everyone. So cortisol is indeed a marker of fatigue. It's been observed in more than 1,000 studies, but marker, not cause of fatigue. So debunking adrenal fatigue, it is important for us to elucidate step by step. Three important points here. There are effective ways to help fatigue patients without the use of hormones, unless you have a primary or real hormone etiology for it. Sometimes we oversimplify the therapy by giving glucocorticoid to patients that complain about fatigue, where in fact you need to spend more time with these patients. So we are now, I'm an enthusiast of the movement called slow medicine, just like slow food in the counterpart as is fast food. We are now performing slow medicine, so my first consultation takes 90 minutes. My follow-up consultation takes 60 minutes with each patient, and it gives me a way better diagnosis and therapies for these patients and their satisfaction levels as well. And one thing that I want to call attention here is that I get sometimes pissed off that traditional doctors, which I'm kind of part of, they think that all other medicines are the same thing. They do not know the difference between lifestyle medicine, natural medicine, anti-aging, functional medicine. So they think they're all the same. They confirm that, oh, anything that is not written in the guideline, they just say bullshit. Whereas we think that we know that guidelines are not meant to be followed all the time. So first of all, we would think, they say that the chronic stimulation of the adrenal glands would lead to an adrenal failure, like adrenal exhaustion. If we thought this way, our pituitary after menopause would get fatigued, and the LH and FSH would decrease within like months of trying to stimulate the failure gonads. Likewise, we have hypothyroidism with increased TSH. If you do not get a patient in a certain window, you lose that hyper TSH levels with time because the the cells in the pituitary would get fatigued as well. Oh, but pancreas shows a decrease in insulin levels with time. Yes, but because of glycotoxicity, not because of the beta cells getting fatigued. So what would make adrenal gland so unique to make it to get fatigue with time of overstimulation? It doesn't really have anything special. Adrenal is indeed a very special gland, but it's not as special that would make this unique to get fatigued. That has no substantiation for this rationale. So you'd say, oh, strict criteria for adrenal sufficiency. Yes, we do have a criteria for adrenal sufficiency is very strict. But we have several tools to diagnose relative adrenal sufficiency. It's not that we do not have tools. If adrenal insufficiency is primary, the ACTH levels increase way before any changes in cortisol, similarly to what happens in hypothyroidism. It happens in hypocortisolism when it's primary, increasing ACTH levels, okay? And in the case you find a secondary adrenal insufficiency like hypophysitis, lymphocytic hypophysitis, a condition that is underdiagnosed. And every central, the bad thing about central hormone dysfunctions is that you lose what you usually use as markers. So if you have panhypopituitarism, you lose the control of the hormones that you usually use for the diagnosis. So you have a normal TSH, but a low T3 and T4 level, so you have a central hypothyroidism, and sometimes you're mixed with Hashimoto's, so you have some challenging diseases here, a diagnosis. But you have several simulation tests to perform where you can find relative adrenal sufficiency. So the fact that it's, and I do believe that a relative adrenal sufficiency is underdiagnosed, it doesn't mean that you can use non-standardized ways to make this diagnosis. We do have tools for the diagnosis. This is important to tell you. And it seems that nobody knows this. There are several mechanisms that were mentioned as possible that make plays a role in the pathophysiology of adrenal fatigue, such as overexpression of the HPA axis with a chronic stimulation from stress, which leads to downregulation to glucocorticoid receptors. Indeed, corticoid steroids are very small molecules with only, in the case of cortisol, only 21 atoms of carbon. So it passes through the membrane easily. So their receptors is located inside the cell. And when it couples with its receptor, it goes inside the nucleus. So receptors that are located not in the membrane but inside the cell, they're easier to be down and up regulated. So it would make a little bit of sense, although it has never been shown, except in some polymorphisms. Apoplexy of the fasciculata layer. The fasciculata layer is a layer where the final product is cortisol. Or an accentuated, an exacerbated pituitary response to the CRH. But this accentuated pituitary response would lead to a hypercortisolism instead. These are all brought from articles that mentioned. So this is nothing that I invent in here. That's everything brought from articles and studies, mostly descriptive. Chronic fatigue is the most complaint. I left here up to 40% of population because it's been said so in articles, but I do believe it's way more than this. But we have a lot of causes for this. Use of glucocorticoids improves a sense of fatigue regardless of your basal state. Anyone who uses glucocorticoid will feel a better energy in the first days or weeks. This is an inherent effect of the corticoids. So you cannot base your assumption that the person has cortisol impairment production if he gets better with the use of corticoid. So this is a false premise that a therapeutical test cannot be used because corticoids induce some improvement. So this is important for us to know. And one thing that just been published that the short-term use of corticoids with a GLP-1 analog for obesity, I work a lot of obesity, induce a double weight loss because it reduces the brain inflammation. But afterwards, we can talk about this. It's just been published last week. So everything's about hormone balance. It's important for you to tell you. So there's one thing you guys should know is that more important maybe than the cortisol levels are the cortisol activity in the tissues. There is an enzyme called 11-beta-hydroxysteroid dehydrogenases that convert cortisol to cortisone. For example, licorice that a lot of people use to improve their energy levels actually inhibits the conversion of cortisol in cortisone. So it increases the cortisol tissue exposure. This is proven. But at the same time, excessive cortisol inside the tissue performs a mineralocorticoid action and gives you hypertension and hypokalemia. So you have a lot of articles showing that. So it's all about balance. All this salivary cortisol rhythm, basal cortisol level, hair cortisol, questionnaires are merely based on assumptions and have never really been proven. Questionnaires, for example, are amazing to assess fatigue, to quantify fatigue, which is a quite subjective, and we could call fatigability. There is a new dimension of the CK of fatigability. It's a new hypothesis some authors have proposed to dimension fatigue. But this is to quantify fatigue, not the etiology. So we need to be careful. You cannot get a questionnaire from Dr. Wilson. It may be very good to quantify your fatigue state, your fatigue level, but not the cause of fatigue. We should be always aware of the difference between association and causality. So the misuse of a glucocorticoid, this is very important for you guys now to know. Even in low doses, glucocorticoid can induce several risks, including myopathy, glaucoma. Glaucoma is only caused by exogenous corticoid, not endogenous, okay? Metabolic dysfunctions, sleep disturbances, and cardiovascular diseases. So we need to be careful when prescribing glucocorticoid. We need to be quite sure that why you're prescribing it for. I'd rather use natural medicine, as I'm going to show further, because it probably helps more of the root of the cause. So cause of fatigue here, we have more than 90, actually more than 100. Some recent papers after I delivered this presentation to Metagenics, type 1 diabetes is also related. In Brazil, we have the Zika virus. That is way worse than you guys think. And the chikungunya, these viruses are leading to long-term fatigue states. It's quite embarrassing. We see patients having arthralgia, fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndrome, and immune disruptions after the Zika and the chikungunya virus. It's really weird the way it's being spread. Well, this is another subject we can talk about later or in private. But we have several other dysfunctions. Post-head injury, we have a very usual complaint of head. After you have a head injury, you have like a fatigue state that can be prolonged to up to 1 to 2 years. After an ICU unit, regardless of the cause you went for an ICU, you have an overall evaluation that have increased prevalence of fatigue after the ICU. We do not know exactly if there are substances used there to try to maintain the blood pressure in case of sepsis. It depends. But the thing is that we have a lot of causes for fatigue, including hormonal use of medications that you would never expect. And all these causes that are here were reported in literature, even the unexpected ones. So if you see here, fatigue is a major complaint. We have dysfunctional psychological issues, sleep disorders. To me, sleep disorders, we never talk about sleep hygienesis. So every time I go to sleep, I turn off my Wi-Fi, turn off the cell phone, try to have the best quality of sleep. And this does make a lot of differences in the long run, and we are not paying attention to that. So more important, the amount of sleep you have is the quality of sleep we have. And one easy way to ask, I always say, you know how the night was by how the day is. So the more fatigued the person is, you can know that the quality of the sleep, besides the other causes for fatigue, has a direct relation. So sleep is more important than just assessing hormone here, hormone there, and thinking about other causes for fatigue. Burnout, depression, fibromyalgia, and a very important thing, endocrine disruptions are, everyone is talking about endocrine disruption here, but indeed, even for endocrinology societies, endocrine disruptors have become one isolated field of endocrinology, so important it has been shown. So, and these conditions are intercorrelated. So fibromyalgia is linked to lower T3, conversion T4 to T3 in some certain tissues. Likewise, chronic fatigue syndrome with impaired CDH and natural killer cells function, which is correlated with some cytokines. So they're all intercorrelated. It's impossible for you to treat a patient each field by each field, each path by each path. You should treat the patient, not exam, and you should treat the patient as an only person, a huge and complex web. This is quite important. If you have time to assess these points with patients, these are many times more important than any medical condition. So chronic unsolved problems, the lack of definition of your life, what you're going to do about your life in terms of family or job, feelings of guilt or job satisfaction, addiction to sugar or other carbohydrates. We know that addiction to sugar increase your interleukin 1 levels. And I was just telling some colleagues that a study used an interleukin 1 antagonist, and it prevented for you to have the fatigue related to the excessive carbohydrate intake. Of course, you're not going to take the drug. You're going to eat less carbohydrate. But just to show the mechanism behind the postprandial fatigue. Or consequence of a chronic avoidance of self-perception of tiredness. So you have to take care, you have to raise your kids, you have to work, you have social problems, you have financial problems, but you don't have the option to get fatigued and to perceive yourself as fatigued. You don't have this option because you have to work and your body has to function. So it reaches a certain point that it breaks down. So no medical conditions are as important as medical conditions, but this requires time for you with your patient. And trust me, when you talk to your patient, the first 15 minutes are kind of a waste of time for the patient to get relaxed. And just after 15 minutes, he really gets relaxed and start a real confidence with you. And then he tells you everything about his life. That's where you notice that the thing is going on. When we talk about men's health tomorrow, you're going to see that how important stressful situations and stress environment it is for the libido. So this is very interesting. I brought a lot of new data published this year. With the metabolomic basically is just like genomic, is a metabolic panel. It's a huge panel of all the metabolites. There were some theories regarding immunologic and inflammatory, muscular, antioxidant, hypometabolic theories, hypovolemic, chronic dehydration. All these playing together as synergistic effect among them, leading to the chronic fatigue. So when you come here, each of the studies show impaired pathways. Then you can read there. I left many of the information. These slides are pretty dirty, are pretty plain of information for you guys to have access. So they're mostly a guide for us here. But the most important thing is that at least 50 metabolic pathways are impaired in fatigue states, okay? So, and none of these pathways are related to adrenal. So you have at least 50 metabolic pathways that are impaired in these patients. So it's pretty, and another thing, it's pretty hard to approach this patient and to provide effective help. So we are dealing with a very complex complaint, and I say that a fatigue of a person is unique. If you have like 3 billion people complaining about fatigue, you have a 3 billion combination of factors leading to fatigue. So this is quite hard to help patients. Burnout does exist. Burnout is the result when you do not notice your own fatigue state. So you just break down. It has some similarities with depression, with fibromyalgia, and other panic disorders in terms of pathophysiology. So far, there's no accurate biomarkers. There is this paper here showing there's no structural abnormality in the endocrine organs, but you do have some dysfunctions in serotoninergic activity and some dysfunctions in sympathetic autonomous nervous system as well. There are some dysregulations in the hypothalamus pituitary adrenal axis, indeed, but these are not addressed and evaluated through the classic exams we have access to. So because we keep talking about exams here, so for our everyday life, how do we address these patients? So management, how to use results of studies in clinical practice here. There are certain conditions called cancer-related fatigue. For example, there are some recent published data showing that children that had cancer and were cured, their speed of the telomerase shortened is double the usual. So they have like a DNA age of 65 at the age of 30. So these patients that had cancer, they are extremely fatigued. And we are not aware of exact mechanisms because, for example, we have chemotherapy that leads to fatigue, but even radiotherapy has been shown to be linked to fatigue as well. So we have several studies trying to improve these patients with cancer, and we could perhaps use some of these tools for other related conditions. because we will not be able to wait for 1A evidence studies to try to help these patients that we have in front of us. Sometimes you just need to be empirical and be based on plausibility. So talking about some of the phytotherapy, I think one important thing here is that regardless of the point where it acts, we need to see the results. I think that natural medicine has to be seen this way. It's not a type of medicine that you have placebo-controlled studies. It doesn't make sense for natural medicine. And we need to be less concerned about... Oh, it was raised here. Okay. Turn on again. We should be less concerned about the exact mechanism and be more concerned about the final and clinical outcome. Afterwards, when you see the clinical outcome, you can go research about the mechanism. It does help. It does happen with allopathic drugs. For example, we have the SGLT2 inhibitors for diabetes. It has been shown to decrease cardiovascular risk in a glucose and weight loss and hyperpressure independent effect. And now we are studying the reasons why it leads to a decrease in cardiovascular events. And differently from statins, they published the raw data. So statins are somewhat a little bit complicated to talk about. So there's root extract here. They have antioxidant effects, and they help to manage body weight and fatigue, especially when it's secondary to chronic stress. Okay, so the ashwagandha is a pretty known for everyone here. It does have some evidence, so no one can say that, as you can see here. So if you say there's a lack of papers, no, it's not true. There's a combination between magnolia and philodendron. It helps reduce cortisol levels. Look, this is important. It helps reduce cortisol levels. It does not mean that it acts directly in the adrenals. It likely acts in the brain, reducing stress, and then indirectly go to the pathways, leading to a reduction in cortisol. So cortisol using as a marker, not a causer. It improves anxiety states, and we know that stress, chronic stress, leads to inability for you to have a fat loss and induce a fat. In the short term, cortisol is part of that fight or flight effect, fight or run effect, so it really breaks down fat in the short term, but chronic stress leads to the opposite effect. So everything that is phytotherapic that helps deeper in the causes is way better than giving hormones. And this is an endocrinologist saying that. So the magnolia itself could help, but it likely has some synergistic effects when combined with philodendron. 5-HTP can be used. It has some adrenal-independent fatigue mechanisms. And also, you have some genetic predisposition to respond to tryptophan metabolism. It depends on how your genetic leads with you taking 5-HTP. The use of GABA does cross the blood-brain barrier. So you cannot say, it does not cross, it does cross. There are enough studies showing that. It's a purified extract from the mulberry. It has the possible ability to stimulate growth hormone release. We have this growth hormone release problem in Brazil. We have a lot of women taking supplements and whey protein, and we are having some acromegalic-like syndrome. So these patients, they behave as acromegaly in terms of biochemical. They have increased IGF-1 levels. They have increased growth hormone levels, and growth hormone is not suppressed by carbohydrates, which was supposed to be the diagnosis flowchart for the acromegalic tumor diagnosis. So GABA can make a role somewhat similar to this protein take. So some studies have shown that GABA is better than taurine as an anti-fatigue effect. The use of omega-3 when you associate with zinc supplements, it can really improve, especially cancer-related fatigue. It improves muscle damage recovery and inflammation. And we know that patients with reduced omega-3 overall omega-3 levels they have higher fatigue states when associated with musculoskeletal pain. Vitamin C may reduce adrenal suppression induced by adrenal toxic drugs. This is interesting. We have some adrenal toxic drugs. For example, if you take antifungic, we use ketoconazole for suppression of adrenal. In case of adrenal carcinoma, for example, or Cushing's before the surgery of Cushing's disorder. It may reduce some of the harmful effects of the hormone profile. Perhaps the action of vitamin C is higher than only in adrenal, so this is important for you to know. If you perform any test that directly tests adrenal, you will not see any differences regarding vitamin C, for example. You need to see this patient in a wider view only than adrenal. Vitamin D has some effects on the 11-beta hydroxysteroid deshydrogenases, as I told you, decreasing the cortisol-cortisone ratio. It's highly prevalent in cancer-related fatigue. So vitamin D has this current issue between association and causality. Sometimes I always say that better than vitamin D, the essays for those in vitamin D are somewhat inaccurate. So using PTH as the marker, indirect marker for vitamin D status may be a little bit more appropriate in some cases. So we want a PTH level below 25. So if you have a PTH of 50, 55, unless the patient has primary hyperparathyroidism, they may have low vitamin D, regardless of the serum vitamin D levels you have. If you dose in three different labs, you're probably going to have three different vitamin D levels, even if dosed at the same day. And it helps the fatigue related to any autoimmune disorder. So vitamin D is a good thing for you to use in these patients. So the HMB helps not only athletes after the training sessions, but also when you do not train, it improves the fatigue-related symptoms, like, for example, for fibromyalgia, and the fatigue induced by cachexia as well. So HMB is a very useful supplement for patients independent of their physical activity. Arginine is another growth hormone inducer, and it really helps fatigue through an antioxidant system. An extract mix of astragale and salvia. It has some pharmacological effects against fatigue in terms of the energy metabolism. And it has some protective effects on the brain. So all these, I'm telling you one thing, all these points raised by my slides here are completely and scientifically based. It's not my opinion. It's totally based. You can look for all the studies that I have included in the lower part here. So there's nothing invented from my brain, okay? Just to let you know. Ginseng reduced fatigue levels. There are some recent studies on ginseng now on prevention of Alzheimer's, just published like 2 weeks ago. Gut microbiota. So we know that the microbiota has an important role in all the disease that we have. Now we are trying to learn and understand how to deal with these patients, how to change and maintain the changes that we want in the gut microbiota. So we do have some issues regarding this. The fecal microbiota transplantation could be effective for patients that are refractory to other types of therapy. So fecal transplantation was pretty famous in the decade of 40s. For weight loss, and it does induce weight loss because of the types of bacteria you have inside of your bowel. and also for fatigue may be helpful. But it's hard for you to do in practice, of course. And I do not suggest eating, okay? It should be fecal introduction. So, rhodiola, it helps in remission of menopause symptoms, including fatigue. It does improve at least 11 biomarkers of fatigue. There are many other options here. I think the worst thing is how to deal, which one to choose. I think the most important thing is to understand why your patient is fatigued. So there are many, many, many options here out of the market. So you cannot say that there are no options to help these patients with fatigue. You don't need to use hydrocortisone. So we also have, more important than anything, non-pharmacological approaches. I'm now one of the directors of the Brazilian Lifestyle Medicine Association. We, in Brazil, we try to have only board-certified doctors for the Lifestyle Association. So we, to be based and to have a conversation with the traditional medical associations. So weight loss usually help a lot because weight is an inflammatory disorder. So the weight loss could induce. The problem is that we are chemically addicted to carbohydrate and high fat. Exercise in the right intensity. There's a minimum amount of carbohydrates. We're going to talk about this on Monday. Extremely low carbohydrate in the long term can lead to fatigue. Sometimes low carbohydrate diets, extremely low carbohydrate diets can lead to fatigue in the long term. Improvement in sleep quality. It's pretty hard for you to always sleep better. Sometimes you have to help these patients. Improvement of diet. Lower magnesium and folate are linked to increased fatigue. So one thing here, in terms of prevention of idiopathic fatigue states. So we are now in a fatigued society. I think there more than depression, we have fatigue. We know that extreme fatigue can imitate depression. Adequate sleep, healthy lifestyle, solved problems. Sometimes a problem that is not so, sometimes it's better for you to have a problem that it's solved even for the worst way than have unsolved problems. It really makes you fatigued. And spirituality doesn't mean that you need to believe in God. You just need to have yourself solved, your perceptions over the planet. And to try to avoid, I mean, when you make detox, you better, as important as detoxifying your body, is detoxifying your soul from toxic people, toxic environment, toxic work, social media, and unpleasant activities. Trust me, this really makes a lot of people fatigued. So characterize fatigue. Is it part of a more important symptomality? Or it's not part of anything, it's isolated? Duration, intensity. Is it progressive? Is it intermittent? Can you find triggers? Sleeping characteristics are pretty important. Every time someone says fatigue, you have to ask about sleep. Okay, this can take time, but it's more important than just giving medications. Medical history based previous diagnosis. Investigation fatigue. I would include here vitamin B12, TSH, anti-PTPO, free T3, some hormones, some inflammatory markers. And then additionally, I would investigate other hormones. And in the end, I would go for body analysis. So this is just a basic suggestions that you can have. It's easier for you to have your health insurance covering. I did not mention here that exams not covered by health insurances because we know it's hard sometimes for you to pay patient to pay cash for everything. But this, I tell you, this can help. This, with a good anamnesis and a good medical history and personal history, can make you find the cause of fatigue in 99% of patients. And treat the patient. Fatigue specific approaches according to the likely mechanisms that led to fatigue. So here you could have a huge flow chart because you have more than 100 causes. Sleep is the number one. I think that regardless of the etiology for fatigue, talking about sleep quality is a must talk subject during a consultation. Detox and healthy diet and exercise in the right intensity, never too much and not too low. There's a right way to do it. And in conclusion, adrenal fatigue in the way it's leaked does not exist. I think you can say chronic fatigue. You just not can confound, you cannot confound with chronic fatigue syndrome, CFS. You can use cortisol in several different ways as markers of fatigue. And if you have any doubt in regarding the adrenal function and reserve, adrenal reserve, you should perform any of the simulation tests. Basal cortisol are awful for you, exception is when you have a very, very low cortisol levels. And one important thing, you will have high cortisol levels in women undertaking anticonceptional, oral contraceptives, because oral contraceptives increase a lot CBG levels, so cortisol binding globulin levels, so it falsely increases total cortisol levels. So your cortisol levels in women taking oral contraceptive will be high. So you need, in this case, you can perform the salivary, which is the free form, the free cortisol, or you can make a 24-hour free free urinary cortisol as well. And simply, I say, simply detox. Detox from your everyday environment. Detox from digital media sometimes. You get addicted. You get there. You don't have time to write an article, but you have time to check your Instagram and your Facebook all the time. Detox from Wi-Fi waves. I still think that Wi-Fi is being under-recognized as a cause for several issues. I don't know your opinion, but I think there is an interest in not studying what can lead, because we would have to change a lot the way we deal with Wi-Fi. Detox from harmful effects of social medias. I think that we were in the right time, like 12, 15 years ago, when we used to have the Orkut, when we used to access our email once a day. We arrived at home, we have access to our email once a day, and that was it. Now we are constantly exposed to emails, messages, several ways of communication, and we have become slaves from the digital media. And if you do not respond at the exact time they send to you, they complain. So we have become slaves and did not notice, okay? So sometimes just turn off your cell phone, though, so it shows that it was not delivered, the message that you receive. Can make you a little bit lighter sometimes. Detox from toxic people, I don't know if you guys believe, so energy, some people do pull energy, and I do believe in it. I'm just at a stage that I don't care if people believe or not, I just noticed this. And so just try to detox from all these environments, and you'll probably see improvement on your fatigue state, rather than just giving you hormones. That's it.